Now, in the RNIB Talking Books Library, you can go on a French garden odyssey with Monty Don's The Road to Laetona Lea.
The weather south from Orange had been a growing revelation. This was 1973. Hardly anyone went abroad. My mother had never set foot in France, and my father went once in 1939 to kill Germans, and then almost get killed by them at Dunkirk. He never went back. Other than the weekend in Paris when I was 14, the furthest south I had been before was the Isle of Wight. Now it was autumn, yet the sun shone from a blue sky. People were tanned, wore dark glasses and smiled a lot. X was full of people my age sitting in street cafes drinking lager, citron pressé or real coffee. There were markets filled with vegetables I did not recognise, and crepe for sale on the street. By existing almost exclusively on bread and cheese, it was possible to live for just a few francs a day.
A clip from Monty Don's French garden odyssey, The Road to Laetona Lea. It was read by Greg Wagland. I'll be joined later by a blind gardener to discuss all things sensory in the outdoors. But for the moment, Monty Don joined me on the line and told me about The Road to Laetona Lea.
Well, I think the crucial thing is that it is not a book about French gardens. And this, it's bad to define things by what they're not, but it's, in this case, easier. It's a book about my experiences and relationship to France through the medium of its garden, and from the age of 14 up to nearly 60. So in other words, it's about my lifelong contact with France and its gardens. Admittedly, quite sporadic, but it's a personal book. That's the point. It's not an objective study. The selection of gardens is entirely personal and erratic and arbitrary, and it's really trying to look at gardens from the perspective of a traveller, really, rather than the perspective of a horticulturist.
Is it frustrating to write about gardens rather than having a TV camera there and you can just say,
no, I much prefer it. I much prefer writing about gardens and talking about them on telly. Much more frustrating to do it on television. Because when you write about gardens, you can write about anything. You can make it as long or as short as you like. You can describe things that aren't happening in front of your eye. You can describe things that happened in 1662 and 1837 and yesterday and last autumn and next year. On telly, you can only show what there is to be seen. Mm-hmm. And also, you've probably got about 2 minutes to do it. Writing books is freedom. Writing books is me saying what I want to say. Television is the art of compromise. I mean, it's an interesting art and one that I love, but it's all television is about trying to cram at least a quart into a pint pot, and usually more like a whole great big milk container lorry into a pint pot. So in other words, you're always whittling down. And then, you see, when it's filmed, about up to three quarters of what we film will be chucked away. And at least a third will be chucked. And I have no control over what is thrown and what is kept. I'm not in the edit suite. Very often, what I consider to be my best work is never shown because there might have been sound problems or the images may not have quite worked, or it was just felt that it didn't quite fit in with other things. So that's the downside of filming. The upside is you're working as part of a team of experts who are very good at their jobs, and you are just one cog in that machine. Whereas a writer, you are the machine. It's you on your own. And a book like this one, I sat where I'm talking to you now in this room for, I wrote it very fast and very intensively because it had years of notes and I'd spent the whole year traveling. But it still took me about 12 weeks of doing nothing else at all from morning till night to do that. And if I hadn't had a family, I wouldn't have spoken to anyone else. I would have had no other contact. So writing is any book. It doesn't matter if it's the great novel or if it's a book about dog grooming. It's a lonely, solitary, repetitive work. And what makes it good is when it comes alive, when it becomes fantasy, when when what's in your head goes onto the page.
Would you say that's the same as gardening? Could that be lonely
no,
and repetitive?
No, it's not. Gardening is very different. Gardening, you're working with nature. That's the whole thing. You're not trying to... It's a terrible mistake that people make about gardens, which is trying to create a garden and impose it onto the landscapes or onto the plot. Good gardens, all good gardens, are the synthesis of mankind's creativity and the natural world's bounty. And at their most successful, they harmonize, sometimes in surprising ways, but they work together always. And I think when you're writing, it's a blank page. It's absolutely what you put on the page. Television, as I say, is a machine, and it's a team. And when it's good, it's greater than the sum of its parts. But you're still, it's an artifact. You know, you still can fiddle around with it, and you can change things. Gardening is much more intuitive, much more responsive. It's a longer, slower, good gardens, good gardening happens across years, lifetimes. Increasingly, I feel that happen across centuries, you know, that my garden is just a layer, a very thin skin on this earth. And when I go, someone else will add another thin layer. And so it builds up. And sometimes I feel when I'm in the garden, I'm connected to thousands of years of tending this soil. And that's a very enriching experience. And other times you're just dealing with one plant. It's very beautiful, and you're looking after it. So I think gardening is creative, and I think it can be an art form, but it's very different to writing.
Now, I'm also joined on the line by blind gardener Kevin Smith. Now, Kevin, how did you get into blind gardening?
I always loved gardening. When I could see, I lost my sight 5 years ago, and when I could see, I always loved gardening, and I was a little bit lost for quite a while. I had a great good fortune to move in with Pocklington in Roehampton. And one of the care workers saw, you know, I was talking to him about how much I love gardening, and he found out a charity called Thrive, who work up in Battersea Park. Well, they died about all over the place, but Battersea Park's where I went. I've now got a qualification in horticulture, and it's lovely. It's absolutely lovely.
Now, Kevin, why do you feel it's important to support Thrive and RNIB?
Well, I lost my sight very suddenly 5 years ago, and I've had so much help from people that I didn't know existed until I lost my sight. And they've supported me even when I'm shouting and yelling at them and got the ump about life. It's all right. It's been okay, and they've listened and helped. And I think it's so important to put back. It's like you know, when you're growing, you know, you've got to make sure the earth's right for the plant to grow in. And if I help dig the earth over and, I don't know, put fertilizer on it, then other plants can grow. And hopefully by being part of something, putting something back, somebody else gets some help as well. And they've been wonderful to me, absolutely wonderful.
Now, Kevin, I'm also joined on the line by Monty Dawn, and I believe you've got a question for him.
Yes, hello, Monty. Thanks for taking part. It's just really about how important do you think texture and sound and scent and the non-visual aspects of gardening are?
I think it's absolutely key. And I think in gardening, as in most things, that people with good sight tend to let that have much more dominance over their other senses. But, years ago I wrote a book called The Sensuous Garden, which was all about using the different senses and how you can garden to make the most of them. And I suppose after sight, the most obvious one is scent, because scent works on such a primeval way. It goes right to the oldest part of our brain. And as we know, scent and memory are inextricably linked, because you can't recognize smells except through memory. There's no way of knowing a smell except through an experience. So, for example, you smell an orange, and you will identify it as an orange through something that happened to you in your past. And the two parts of the brain are exactly the same. So it's very personal and very powerful. And when we're designing a garden for scent, we should use that. Just think, you know, what sense do we want? It's not enough just to say I want it to smell any more than I want it to look. You know, we don't plant plants just because we want color. We want to choose what color. How do we want it to work? How is it going to affect us? Do we want a smell that's going to invigorate us or to calm us down or to to remind us of our childhood or the day that we got married or you know, a perfume or a meal or whatever. Designing scent can really dramatically affect your garden. So, A, include it as much as possible, and B, work on it. And also different times of day. So, for example, plants like tobacco plants only really smell in the evening. A lot of plants have oils which heat up during the day, then release their scent at night, particularly white ones, because that attracts pollinating insects at night on a warm day. So where are you going to be at night? You don't want those scents happening in a part of the garden you never go into in the evening. You want to be where you sit, and so on and so forth. So understanding that dramatically enriches one's experience of the garden. Taste is the other one that is clear. Is, you know, we grow food to nourish ourselves, but it's got to taste good. It's got to have real taste. And as any keen vegetable gardener will tell you only too willingly, no food tastes better than your own veg straight from the garden. And it's not enough just to say, oh, it's food. It's, you know, what are you eating? What does it actually taste of? What? Try and describe it. New potatoes from the garden taste much sweeter than any new potato you can buy, and that's because the sugars turn to starch very quickly. And so if you eat them within a few hours, they will be sweeter. And that's true of sweet corn, and it's true of asparagus and peas, which is why, you know, peas tend to be frozen in the field. So that maximizing taste. And that those are the two obvious ones. But the other two senses, which I feel we don't really use enough, are sound, particularly plants like grasses. When the wind catches them, they rustle and shift. When you have the leaves I have hornbeam hedges in my garden, and at this time of year, just before they grow their new leaves, the old leaves are very dry and brittle. And when there's a slight wind, they patter. It sounds exactly like rain. And you hear this rain falling on a clear, bright day. And it's the leaves. It's a very particular sound. Frost has a sound when you walk in on the grass. Obviously, wind makes sound, but you can attract birds to your garden. Sound is really important. The sound of your footfall on a mossy, softer surface as opposed to a hard surface.
And the sound of running water as well.
Incredibly important. Really, really important. And the final one, which, again, we undervalue. I'm sure everybody's aware of it, but we don't value its importance, except for people who are completely blind, is touch. You know, plant plants so that when you walk, you can trail your hand along and touch. And sometimes they'll have a scent. If you walk past a rosemary bush and run your hand down the length, you will release oils that will have, not only will you feel it, but you'll smell it. Other plants are very soft and feathery. If you have a box hedge, I've got a box hedge, like just to automatically, without thinking, I just brush my hand along the top of it as I pass. Touch, both on your hand, on your feet. Maybe you have a gap in the garden where you have to slightly push past very soft plants that aren't at all abrasive. This is all part of the language, the sensory language of your garden. And it doesn't matter whether you're sighted or not. To waste that opportunity, not to fully embrace it, is not to fully embrace the faculties that you have. It doesn't matter whether you're fully sighted or totally blind or partially sighted or whatever. Not to embrace all the possibilities of your senses. Yeah. It's crazy. And people have this idea that, oh, if you're blind, then you need to develop your touch or your taste or whatever. I think that's just rubbish. I think we all do. You know, we all should use our senses to the maximum ability. And the best place to do that is in the garden. Just on your skin, you can feel a kind of air that hits you from different plants. Sometimes it's hot and bakes back. Sometimes it's cool. That's all important. It's all feeding in and the message. And some gardens that we love, actually, if you try to analyze it, we love it because it just feels nice. And that's about as articulate as you can get. I often walk around my own garden barefoot, silently. So just try and I would say to anybody is go into your garden and don't try and see, smell, hear, or touch anything. Don't try and think anything. Just let it come to you. If you walk, walk gently. Let it come, and all kinds of things start flooding in and coming to you. It's incredibly enriching, but at the same time, restful experience.
It is, and all of a sudden, you've got no worries, you've got no troubles, and you think, well, I'll just sit here for a bit longer.
Yeah, exactly that. That's good, good.
Monty Doan and Kevin Smith, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.